As American society has changed, the face of TV news has slowly caught up with it. Two women have been anchoring the nation's three most prominent evening news shows, and the country's racial and ethnic diversity is reflected as well. Yet as NPR's David Folkenflik reports, there is one way in which TV anchors live in a very different world.
CNN's Don Lemon is on TV a lot. He is the network's weekend primetime anchor, but you've never heard him say what he's about to say. And Lemon says he's been advised not to.
Do I want to be the gay anchor? Which is what my mentors in the business, my agents, the people I respect said, do you want to always be labeled as the gay anchor? And I'd have to say at this point, why the hell not?
Don Lemon is 45. He's from Baton Rouge, Louisiana, an African-American raised Southern Baptist who attended Catholic schools, went to Brooklyn College, and prospered in the competitive world of TV news. Oh, and he's gay. As a kid, Lemon says he knew he was different, but kept hearing the call in church to
pray the gay away.
Colleagues at work do know about his four-year relationship with his boyfriend, a CNN producer. But until now, Lemon has been extremely guarded with the public. He was told anchors do not talk about such things.
We live and die by people watching us. If I give people another reason not to watch me, that is a concern for me, and that's a concern for whoever I am working for. My livelihood is on the line. I don't know if people are going to accept me. I don't know if I'll have a job. I don't know how people are going to feel about this.
Lemon spoke with NPR ahead of the release of his memoir, Transparent, in which he talks about his upbringing, his discovery of who his true father was, and about the sexual abuse he suffered as a child. Lemon first disclosed that on CNN last fall during an interview about a prominent minister accused of abuse.
You want me to tell you what got my attention about this, and I've never admitted this on television. I am a victim of a pedophile when I was a kid.
Lemon was writing his memoir at the time. He says it was cathartic to release secrets he had been holding so tight. And yet Lemon says he was scared, is scared, that he will pay a price.
Most people would think, if you're the prime news anchor, then you should sort of be this Edward R. Murrow kind of Clark Kent kind of guy with the family and the 2.5 kids, or the perky, cute, yet smart Katie Couric. Anyone would have to be naive to think that it wouldn't make a difference.
In some ways, our conversation felt oddly retro. After all, Americans say they are accepting of homosexuality by nearly a 2-to-1 margin. The Defense Department is lifting the ban on gays in the military. Former Vice President Dick Cheney, hardly a liberal, has embraced the idea of gay marriage. I asked Lemon, surely his own mentors don't think being gay is a negative in this day and age.
Yeah, I don't know about that.
Tell me I'm wrong.
Yeah, you're wrong.
Okay.
Yeah, you're wrong.
Look around, Lemon says. There are no openly gay U.S. senators or Supreme Court justices. No one who's gay in the NFL or the NBA. Few top-paid openly gay or lesbian Hollywood stars. And there are almost no openly gay leading news anchors or correspondents in TV news. Former ABC News President David Westin.
When you're talking about particularly on-air personalities, and this is a problem with these jobs, you'd be shocked at what you talk about. You talk about hairstyles, you talk about accents. So you talk about everything. And so among those things, yeah, we would talk from time to time about the question of sexual orientation and whether it would make a difference.
He said executives concluded being gay was not disqualifying for an anchor, but that some viewers would turn away. TV news ratings, after all, are dropping, and there's a lot of money at stake, millions for top anchors and hundreds of millions for top news outlets.
When you have that fine a margin and you're fighting for every little bit competitive edge you can, then it's understandable that people would be afraid of the unknown. I personally think we will get through there and we'll look back and say, what was the big deal? I think. But until you've done it, you haven't done it.
Westin says he believes, he hopes, attitudes have become more accepting. But as he says, it's the great unknown. A lot of news stories involve sexual orientation, gays in the military, ordination of gay clergy, gay marriage. Lemon says he's concerned some viewers may not accept hearing about such stories from someone whom they know to be gay, though, as Lemon notes, heterosexual anchors, regardless of their private lives or private views, don't have that problem.
It may not be a year, it could be 5 years, or it could be 10 years, but this revelation about my sexuality will end up being on the pro side of the column rather than the con side of the column. And so be it. If in this broadcast industry, the way it works now, that I can't be the anchor man, then my career will transform into something else.
David Folkenflik, NPR News.
And now to an occasional series that we call In Your Ear. That's where we ask some of our guests to share the music they're playing. Today we hear from Janetta Cole, director of the Smithsonian Institution's National Museum of African Art. Besides letting us know about the newest exhibits at the museum, she told us about her favorite African and African American singers and musicians.
I'm Janetta Betch Cole, and I have the joy and, yes, the privilege of serving as the director of the Smithsonian National Museum of African Art. Often when I'm walking through the museum, I'm enjoying listening to African music, listening to a Miriam Makeba.
The picturesque sunset lights up the sky. A magical moment of light passing by. Magic rhythms that beat through the night. Mother Nature's gift for you and I. Africa is my home.
But I will confess, I am absolutely in love with what I call Black improvisational music. Some folk call it jazz. I'm always trying to get away from her, just trying to make Billie Holiday stop telling me about strange fruit, black bodies hanging from trees.
Southern trees bear a strange fruit, blood on the leaves and blood at the root, black bodies swinging in the southern breeze, strange fruit hanging from the poplar tree.
But I also can change the mood, and you kind of need to after that. How about some Coltrane? These are a few of my favorite things. So what am I really sharing? I'm sharing that I am one very fortunate woman to have work that allows me to feast my eyes upon the works of African artists. But I also am a fortunate woman because I have let my ears lead me to hear some of the most exciting, edgy, provocative, soothing music in the world.
That was Janetta Cole, director of the Smithsonian Institution's National Museum of African Art, telling us what's playing in her ears. To hear a full conversation with her, please go to the program page of NPR.org and select Tell Me More. And now we want to tell you about a competition where those involved say the point is not the point, it's the poetry. It's billed as the largest youth poetry slam in the world. It's held in Chicago, and it's called Louder Than a Bomb. And now there's a new documentary about it that is getting big buzz and winning awards even before its official debut. Here's a clip.
So excuse the couple of cockiness I ever show when rocking this, just trying to give my everything for everything I got from this. Kevin Colville told me I could write. My slam coach told me not to hype. I've loved and lost on final stages. The fates told me it's not the night. But still, I thank this forum for help making me so strong, for letting me talk about sex, drugs, basketball, and moms. Fine, farewell to this chapter and to all the joy and laughter. This for every kid whose voice has been louder than a bomb.
That was 2008 Slam Poetry competitor Nate Marshall, and it comes from the new documentary Louder Than a Bomb. Its nationwide theatrical rollout begins today at the IFC Center in New York. It's scheduled to appear on the Oprah Winfrey Network OWN later this year. Here to tell us more about it is the film's co-director, Greg Jacobs. He's with us from NPR member station WBEZ in Chicago. Welcome. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
How did you get on to this?
I just happened to be driving by near Wrigley Field in Chicago with my wife, and there's a famous rock club nearby called the Metro. And that night, on the marquee, there was a sign that said, Louder Than a Bomb High School Poetry Slam Finals tonight, and a line of kids of all shapes and sizes and colors all down the block. Chicago is such a segregated city that it was unusual to see that kind of diversity among youth. And to see it on a Saturday night for kids who were there to see poetry was not something that I remembered doing for fun when I was in high school. And that also meant that there were kids who were on stage who were reading and performing their poems for other kids. That struck me as amazingly brave and unusual. I went back on Monday and talked to my co-director, John Siskel, about how interesting this seemed. And he said, well, let's take a look.
The title of the film comes from the title of the competition itself. Where does that come from?
The idea came shortly after 9/11, actually. The coincidence of 9/11, and at the time in Chicago, there was talk about anti-gang loitering laws that would essentially make it a crime for kids to gather in small groups. And there were a bunch of poets and teachers who were working with these kids in the schools and knew how creative they were, but wanted to provide a safe space for them where they could do the kind of creativity they were seeing without having to worry about the kind of pressures that were then going on in the world. So they decided to create this space by setting up a citywide poetry slam, and they kind of cribbed the title from a Public Enemy song, Louder Than a Bomb, because the notion was these kids' words are more powerful than any weapon.
The film follows three individuals from separate teams and then a team as a whole. And one of the things that I think is interesting is that the film makes the point that this isn't just something that poor kids do when they have nothing else to do, that there are kids from all different backgrounds who are attracted to this, and that's my way of leading with Adam. Here it is.
Poet, breathe now, because once you start your piece, you can die behind that microphone, and death may be breathless, but poetry's deathless, so breath be our savior eternal. Poets, breathe once with me now. That's one poem we all wrote.
So tell me a little bit about Adam Gottlieb. He's from Northside College Prep. Why was he attracted to poetry in general, the poetry slam experience, until Louder Than a Bomb?
I always describe Adam as the most exotic character you will see in any documentary because he is perfectly well-adjusted. He is an incredibly sweet hippie kid from a very comfortable middle-class family. And when you see him in this context at Louder Than a Bomb or at the slam, you kind of think he's going to get beaten up and get his lunch money stolen. But then he gets on stage and he is this absolutely astonishing performer. He sort of represents the incredible community that gets created at this event, where kids from all sides of the city who may never, ever come in contact with each other get to meet and hear each other's stories and learn to respect each other.
And then there's Nova. Nova's kind of a tough cookie. And just give you a little sense of that. Well, instead of playing Nova, we'll play a little bit from her coach when he first met her and how he describes Nova.
I told her, Nova, you did a great job, but you're a freshman and there are a lot of upperclassmen with more experience who are going to make the team ahead of you. She gave me this mean, dirty look. She stormed out the room and I heard her say something like, I didn't make the team because I'm a god. Freshman, what kind of bull is that? And fortunately, she didn't just throw in the towel at that point. But it was clear no one was going to mess with this kid.
And how did she get drawn to this poetry slam? And tell us a little bit more about her life, if you would, about why, in part, why she's so tough.
Yeah, she's a beautiful young woman, half Indian, half African American, with a 1,000-watt smile, but she is absolute steel. She grew up in a family of, I think, four kids, and her youngest brother, Cody, has something called Fragile X syndrome and a whole other host of problems. Her parents got divorced, and that left her mom to work three jobs and essentially left Nova to take care of Cody. So while everybody else was out having fun and partying and whatever, Nova was always the incredibly responsible one. By the time she got into high school, she had a lot of anger because of that. So her coach convinced her to sign up for the slam team, and she did. And having this outlet really seemed to make everything better.
Tell us a little bit about, more about Nate Marshall, whom we met in the beginning of the introduction. We played a short clip from him. Tell me about why you picked him.
His parents, when he was very, very little, were both drug addicts. They soon afterwards cleaned up. And ultimately, the home Nate came from was a very loving kind of working class house, with his mom in particular as this incredibly strong central figure. And he was identified early on as gifted. He is an extraordinarily talented writer as well as an extraordinarily talented rapper. One of my favorite moments in the film, at the very end, when we're asking the kids what they plan on doing, he says he's going to go to grad school, become a professor, and or rap star.
Well, of course.
Yeah, maybe both.
What else would you do, exactly? If you're just joining us, this is Tell Me More from NPR News. We're speaking with Greg Jacobs, co-director of Louder Than a Bomb. It's a new documentary about the world's largest youth poetry slam held in Chicago. The poetry slam is by the same name, and the film begins its national theatrical rollout tonight in New York. Greg, we've been talking about some of the characters in the film, but I do have to mention that this film has been very well received even before it's been viewed nationally. I'm wondering what you think people are responding to. I don't think you'll mind my mentioning it's won 11 Festival Awards before it's even been widely seen. So what do you think people respond to?
I think people see hope in these kids. They see profound love in the teachers and the parents and the community around them. And the hope is that they leave the theater feeling that the world's a better place than when they walked in.
I wanted to ask about that, too, because one of the things that the film follows is the team from Steinmetz Academic Center, which is they describe it as not being one of the places that people think excellence comes from. And we are living in a time when there's a lot of talk about American education and teachers are up to snuff, whether the kids are learning enough. There are some people who have the impression that just kids are going to hell in a handbasket. Is part of the message of this film, no, they're not? Or is part of the message of the film that any kid can be great if they find something that they love?
That second way is a very good way to put it. The Steinmetz kids got started, and a lot of the themes of their work involve how much talent there is at Steinmetz that doesn't really have an outlet. The expectations are so low and the assumptions about these kids are so low that nothing ever happens with it. So I think the Steinmetz kids are such an inspiration because they are sort of what happens if you're banging your head against the ceiling and then all of a sudden there's a space and you get to fly out of it.
And has it whetted your desire to write a few poems yourself?
I am not going to be writing any poetry because seeing how good these kids are make me say I'm just happy to be on the other side of the camera.
All right. Greg Jacobs is the co-director of Louder Than a Bomb. It's a documentary about the world's largest high school performance poetry competition by the same name. Its national theatrical release starts today. And Greg Jacobs was with us from Chicago. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
If you'd like to find out how you can see the film, we'll link to its website on our website. Go to npr.org, click on the Programs tab, and then on Tell Me More. So now you've come back from the restaurant and you've had your small plate and you want to watch some shows. What are you going to watch? This week, the television networks announced their new lineups for the fall. Here's one of them.
We called the show The X Factor because it was an expression we used a lot. You don't have to necessarily have the best voice. You may not be the best looking person, but you have something which defines you as a star, like Lady Gaga. She's got the X Factor.
That, of course, was Simon Cowell talking about his new singing show, The X Factor, that will premiere on Fox this fall. In addition to more music, the new shows range from a comedy about three men trying to find their inner tough guy to a remake of Charlie's Angels. Across the networks, we expect to see more comedies and dramas with women in the lead. And we wanted to hear more about what we should look forward to and what we should avoid. So we've called on Eric Dagans. He's been following the network's new lineups as the TV critic for the St. Petersburg Times. And he's with us on the line from his office in Florida. Thanks so much for joining us.
Good to be here.
We also wanted to know more about the difficult and often hilarious process of pitching a new television show. So we've also called Fairuza Dumas. She's a commentator and author of two books, Funny in Farsi and Laughing Without an Accent. Last season, she worked with ABC on a TV pilot that ultimately was not picked up by the network. We're sad. And she joins us from a studio in Costa Mesa, California. She's going to tell us about that. Fairuza, thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you for inviting me.
So, Eric, what are some of the shows that you are looking forward to next fall that you would want us to look forward to?
That I'm looking forward to? The short answer is I'm not seeing much yet.
No, that pause was scary.
I know.
Not a good sign.
What we're seeing is that, number one, the networks are stepping up with a lot of new shows. NBC has 12 new shows over next season. I believe ABC has something like 13. CBS Today just announced 5 new shows, which is a lot for them because they're a pretty stable network. So we're going to see a lot of new shows coming. But it's hard to tell from these previews. We really have only seen 2 or 3 minute clips of most of these shows. The critics will get to see the full pilots later this month, and we'll be able to judge better what's going on then. I have not seen much, I'll tell you, that really inspires me very much. The shows seem to be they're banking on comedy a lot. So comics like Whitney Cummings and Chelsea Handler have new shows coming. Tim Allen is coming back to ABC with a show that feels like a thinly veiled, 21st century version of Home Improvement. So there's a lot of comedy coming, and there's this nostalgia. You know, there's 2 shows that seem inspired by Mad Men, one called Pan Am that's on ABC, and one called The Playboy Club that's on NBC. And, the question is, Mad Men is such a specific and very layered show. How in the world is network TV going to do something that has mass appeal with the same kind of focus?
Well, of course, Mad Men is on cable, so that's part of the issue. But, also, before we get to Fariza, you also have reported that the shows that many people talked about last season that had diverse casts, including Outsourced, Detroit 187, Outlaw, The Event, all of those were canceled. Now,
exactly.
A lot of shows were canceled, but did you notice that the diverse shows were the ones that seemed to fall more quickly under the axe?
Well, they on NBC especially, they were. Jimmy Smith's show, Outlaw, I think, was one of the first ones that NBC got rid of. But those shows were also pretty troubled creatively. And one show on NBC, The Event, starring Blair Underwood, did manage to last until the end of the season. I think what we saw was that NBC in particular stepped up and did a lot of shows that had diversity in them. But unfortunately, they did it during a TV season where almost every network canceled almost every new show they put on. So, NBC canceled every show that debuted in its fall, last fall. I believe Fox canceled almost every show. And CBS was the only one that retained more than one show that it debuted in the fall. It retained, I think, 2 or 3. Hmm. So it was just a really bad batting average. And unfortunately, that was the year that at least one network chose to try diversity.
Fariza, you worked with writers to develop a pilot sitcom for ABC based on your memoir, Funny in Farsi. The book is about your life growing up, Iranian-American, in Newport Beach, California. Can you just tell us a little bit about it?
Yes. Well, my memoir starts in the 70s. And so when ABC optioned my book, they decided that the sitcom Funny in Farsi was going to be taking place in the 70s. And this was in the early 70s. So when people still didn't even know where Iran was. And the writers that they hired was a husband and wife team of Jeffrey Hodes and Nesteran Dabai. And Nesteran, the wife, is actually Iranian herself. So it ended up being an absolutely hilarious script. I mean, I was so pleased.
But they didn't pick it up. Any idea why? Does anyone ever tell you?
Well, nobody tells you, but I'll tell you this. The pilot was hilarious. I mean, people in the industry who'd seen it had said it was just one of the funniest pilots they'd seen in a long time. It was also very heartwarming. But at the same time when ABC, the president of ABC, was making his decision whether or not to pick up the show, there was that whole mosque at Ground Zero controversy going on. And I had so much support from literally all over the world. I mean, there was a Facebook page for the sitcom of Funny in Farsi, which had within 2 weeks of 15,000 fans from all over. But given what was going on in this country with this whole just hysteria around this mosque at Ground Zero, it didn't get picked up. And I wonder how much of it was because of that, because it really was a very funny, funny pilot.
Eric, what do you think?
I think they were scared of the show. I think there was no doubt they were probably scared of the show. And, you know, it's interesting. I talked to an actress by the name of Diane Farr, who's also a writer, and she put together a pilot script for a show about interracial relationships. She had a show that she was developing for Fox. And Fox called a huge meeting late in it last year where they got all the producers of all their shows together. In one meeting, had the head of entertainment, Kevin Riley, told them that he wanted more diversity in their shows. And everyone was looking at Diane and saying, wow, this is great. You've got this script, you know, interracial relationships. This is going to be wonderful. And guess which show did not get, guess which pilot script did not get filmed? And you will look at Fox's lineup now, and you'll see that random characters have been changed into people of color. But that doesn't mean that network TV is ready to actually write a show that features the cultures of people of color. I think they're still very careful about that, and it's going to take. It's going to take another Bill Cosby, another Shonda Rhimes to step up and get that done for the network.
On the other hand, there are a number of shows that seem to be targeting female viewers. NBC has 12 new shows; at least 5 have women in the lead. Is that a new thing, Eric?
It feels like there's more of it now, but I think the question is what kind of women are being featured? You know, on NBC, for example, you have the Playboy Club. So this is a show that's centered on, you know, the swinging 60s Hugh Hefner lifestyle. Now, the women in that show, there'll be a lot of them, but they'll all be dressed like bunnies and they'll be serving men. Same with Pan Am. This is about an airline that was founded on the idea of the sexy stewardess. So there are lots of women. Christina Ricci is one of the stars who's on this show. She plays a stewardess, but they're all going to be sexy stewardesses. Whitney Cummings and Chelsea Handler are two comics who are known for being very sexy and very bawdy and also very attractive. So, you know, what is their comedy going to be like? And are women really going to feel like they're being well represented by these shows? We have to see the whole pilots to know, but I'm very suspicious.
I see. Fairuza, we only have about 20 seconds left. So discouraged coming back for more, try again. What's next?
You know, if somebody options a show, you know, is Steven Spielberg, does he listen to your show? But basically, I think ABC really made a huge mistake. Given how much attention I received it just months leading up to this decision, I think the whole world was watching to see if an American network would actually put on a show, a very funny show about an Iranian immigrant family. So I'm really sorry that ABC did not pick up on that opportunity.
Right. Well, hey, FX, life HBO, is long.
All right,
you know, listen up.
Listen up. Radio documentary? Radio serial.
There you go.
Fairuza Dumas is a commentator and author of the books Funny in Farsi and Laughing Without an Accent. She was with us from Costa Mesa, California. Eric Dagans is a TV critic for the St. Petersburg Times, and he was with us from the studios at the newspaper. Thank you both so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And that's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and you're listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow.